Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and WNST.net. We're out of State Fair in Catonsville doing Baltimore Positive, episode two.
Chapter three.
Chapters are for books.
Dr. Malia Cromer from the Sarah T. Hughes Politics Center. Now, Nestor, he views himself as a historian, knowing all things. Folks out there listening, I thought, I've heard that Sarah T. Hughes, and I thought, you know, I'm going to have Malia on. I should know who Sarah T. Hughes is. And when I looked it up, I thought, of course I know who she is. Do you have any idea who Sarah T. Hughes is?
You know, this is where the civics part, where Don, you weren't available to me in social studies in ninth grade. So
I apologize, because until this morning, I should have known her name. I did not. That's bad on me. But Dr. Cromer, inform all of us why we all know who Sarah T. Hughes was.
Sarah Tillman Hughes was the judge who swore in LBJ on Air Force One after Kennedy was shot.
Oh, okay. I've seen that famous picture.
That's right. Yeah, she was short in stature. She's a very small judge who swore him in. She's actually featured in the movie about LBJ that's on HBO. She has it's not a prominent role, but it is part of they use her as part of the storyline. It was a judge that LBJ had advocated for to become a federal judge, and there was sort of some pushback against the Kennedys. But she was the only female currently to ever swear in a sitting president.
And I believe that Damien O'Doherty and Len Foxwell, the only two listeners out there who had a clue who Sarah T. Hughes was until this moment.
All right.
So I want to come back to polling.
Sure.
Because one of the things, having lived this life myself for a number of years, that always gets folks, and I know particularly when you talk to candidates and you're trying to follow a number of polls, they'll go, yeah, you can't. Don't pay any attention to that poll. That's Maryland voters. That doesn't matter at all. The only poll that matters is likely voters. If it's not likely voters, don't pay any attention. Again, tell us, tell our audience, what in the world are they talking about?
So, and again, it's this focus on, with any sort of political poll, they want to do the sort of head-to-head horse race polling. And to do head-to-head horse race polling appropriate, you have to isolate what you would call a likely voter. There is a bunch of different ways to do it. Typically, it is done by a screening method. So, you know, you start with one. If you do adult population at large, which is what the Goucher poll does, you have to ask the first question, are you registered to vote? So anybody who's not registered to vote, drop them out of the sample. They don't get any more questions. You know, the next question is typically a question about interest in the election, how interested you are in the election. Individuals who say they aren't interested in the election, drop from the sample. How likely, or did you vote in the last election cycle? So individuals who vote, voting is habitual. So if you voted before, you're more likely to vote again. And so those individual responses get typically a higher weight than the rest of the responses. And then finally, you follow up with how likely are you to vote? And it's a scale. And typically, you add in a social desirability sort of element to it that say some people are real. You know, sometimes people vote, but other times they just get too busy or things get in the way. And so we purposely sort of prime the respondent.
Just couldn't get there.
So like, it's not a big deal.
You don't use voter rolls.
So you can. So there is RDD sampling, which is what the Goucher poll does, and then there's RBS sampling, registration based sampling.
Okay.
And so there's sort of debates among pollsters which is the best way to do it. I choose RDD, random digit dialing, because I believe it gives you a better coverage of the state as a whole, and that you're able to get individuals, select people into the sample that perhaps are going to register to vote, that might not have registered to vote yet. And there is a lag time between the voter rolls that you purchase to do the RBS sampling and the current time.
How many people really do register at the finish line? And I would think maybe next year, maybe more so, given the state of politics. That's very, you know, I used to travel the world and other places and go other places, and politics would be a topic. Here, it's the last 10 years, it's become much more dinner table through social media. I have a feeling there's a lot of people that have been really yippy the last 3 years, that maybe next year there'll be a little bit more of a rush to say, I want to vote this time for the first time.
Sure. And there might be. And so RDD would capture those individuals. But I think also, more importantly, when you register to vote, you can put a cell phone or a landline down, but you don't have to. So there are gaps in that data. And so not everybody who registers to vote provides a cell phone or landline, and therefore when you do this sort of sampling of RBS, that sometimes there's missing data. RDD corrects for that. However, where RDD, the difference between sort of RDD and RBS is registration-based sampling. You're sure those individuals are, right, are voters. I'm positive. RDD relies on people self telling me that they are. And there is a social desirability issue.
Like, that's what
if I asked you if you're registered to vote, right, you're going to say, of course I was.
Just going to ask you how that's you guard right against that. Because it seems to me that I love that term, social desirability.
It's social desirability.
I've not heard it described that way. It seems to me that when you're nice little college student calls, mm-hmm, and you've trained them and they're chirpy and I'm calling from Gap, I want to tell that student, well, of course I vote. I always vote. How do you guard against that?
No, and it's the same issue with voting as you have about gauging things like racism. You know, you can't call somebody on the phone and ask them if they're a racist. On a scale of one to say, how racist would you say that you are? Right? You're not going to say that.
Right. Would it be Archie Bunker or Trump? Or where would you put yourself in there?
Right, and so it does make a difference. And people do tend to overestimate their likelihood of turning out to vote, I think, in some aspects. But the good thing is but the screening typically does work. And it's worked for us certainly at the Goucher poll in the past.
What's the screening?
The screening method is like, right, so are you registered? Are you interested in voting? Have you voted in the last election cycle? How likely are you to vote in this election cycle? And it creates like a 5-point scale where you're basically not likely at all to, you know, sort of, I'm definitely going to vote. Doesn't matter what's going to happen. I'm definitely going to vote.
And you found that people more often than not tend to answer honestly because your results are validated.
The results seem to be validated for me. And listen, I didn't come up with this methodology. This is a methodology that a lot of other public pollsters use, and it's something that I've adopted from sort of all the other pollsters out there. It's a traditional way to do it. It's a traditional standard.
Well, talk then, building on that. Mm-hmm. Talk about the state of Maryland. And again, as Nestor said, one of the things we're trying to do is to really engage folks in a way, in a deep and rich way, to look at the state, look at the city.
Sure.
We're all joined at the hip. I'm going to say that every time we do this, until people are sick of hearing it. Baltimore and the surrounding, we're joined at the hip.
Please
all,
come back to Baltimore. We're trying to fix it.
Come back to Baltimore. We love
it's
Baltimore
City.
It's
not the city. Wire, I swear. I go to yoga like 4 days a week.
Right.
I walk through.
So we love the city. But when you look at the state, and you poll all over the state, break the state down. What do you find that what unites Maryland voters, I guess, is a way to say it, and then how are they different?
Sure. I think that the lesson that I've learned after 6 years now of collecting data on Marylanders is that old adage of it being the land of middle temperament is true. And that you look at across identifiers, and a plurality of Marylanders identify themselves as moderates. They're mostly Democrats, right? So we have that 2-to-1 Democratic to Republican ratio.
But way more purple than like.
I wouldn't call it purple.
Okay.
No. But I would not call it purple. It is. It's varying shades of blue. That's what I would describe it. It is not purple. This is a
varying
blue state.
Shades of blue with a red governor.
That
would be the contradiction that has us sitting here right now, right?
And he's effectively positioned himself as an independently minded moderate. He doesn't run as a Republican. So, yes, he's a Republican, but the governor, I think, by and large, has tried to find that middle temperament of the state and appeal to that sort of crowd. Where if you look at the sample of where all where Marylanders lie, he appeals to that sort of the heavy middle.
Does Maryland? I'm intrigued.
But that being said, so yes, and everybody always points out the Republican governor, but at the same time, they also sent a supermajority again to the state legislature, and 7 of our 8
are in a country of democracy. We've elected a fascist, right?
In Maryland again, and my friend Kevin Kamenetz, your friend Kevin Kamenetz, and you and he always had some interesting interactions. But he used to say, in the midst of what's going on nationally, don't forget, Maryland is still a state that elects Barbara Mikulski, Ben Cardin, Chris Van Hollen, with these large margins. But I'm going to go back to when you said, what did you say, Maryland? The middle temperament?
It's the land of middle temperament. Yeah, I wish I did not come up with that.
No, but I like that. And you talk about it being a moderate state. Tell us how that
reflects. A moderate blue state.
So tell me what people in a moderate blue state believe.
So they are socially progressive. So individuals in the state are going to be progressive on social issues. But when you press them on tax and infrastructure related issues, you're going to see the, sort of these divides start to happen. By and large, Marylanders believe that they carry a really heavy tax burden. That's thus the appeal of a sort of Republican governor who's focused on keeping a tax burden low. And then issues such as infrastructure, you're going to see the natural divide between urban and rural voters, where urban voters are sort of more pro investing in sort of public transportation infrastructure versus anybody outside the urban corridor. And even some of those folks inside the urban corridor are going to say that we prefer that we put money towards roads and highways. By and large, though, the state is pleased with the direction things are going. And that's, I think, an interesting reflection of our divided government, that we have a situation where you have a Republican governor and a supermajority legislature, and people seem to like the direction. And so I
checks and balances.
Governor Hogan because he's governor, he gets a lot of credit for this, but it's also the Maryland General Assembly. The people also like the kind of leadership of the Maryland General Assembly. And if they didn't, they wouldn't like the way that they wouldn't reflect so much so heavily that they like the state, the way the state is going.
Well, and
it's shared.
As you know, your response to that really answered Nestor's question to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, about Governor Hogan. Because when you talked about that, this moderate Maryland, this middle temperament Maryland, mid-Atlantic temperament, the socially progressive, or certainly not reactionary to social issues, and at the same time, fiscally moderate to conservative. Now, how much of that, Malia, is related? It was interesting in preparing for your visit. I go back, and I'm always fascinated by guys like Frank Luntz, who, has obviously controlled the talking points on the Republican side.
Yep.
And now I know there are some counterbalances, other folks coming forward to try to take that same strategy on the progressive side. And what we don't call it global warming, we call it climate change.
That's right.
We don't call it the estate tax, we call it the
death tax.
So that's what people in your field have brought, right?
That is something that we have done. Yes. And so that's right. And so there's a bunch of different flavors of pollsters. So the particular flavor that I am, you would call me a public pollster. So our goal is to sort of gauge public temperament, but somebody who does this privately for profit, or to the individuals who work for these politicians, they're spending some time doing some message testing. So they're doing the same sort of underlying sampling methodology, but they're going to ask, if you heard that Don Mueller was X, Y, and Z, would you still vote for him? And so they're going to test sort of like your characteristics against a hypothetical challenger. And then from there, they're also going to recruit people to do these focus groups, which is a more qualitative approach to sort of figuring out where voters are on specific issues. The Hogan campaign, and to their credit, during the last election cycle, and they talked about this, it was in the Baltimore Sun, that they had a large focus group of like 100 women. So they knew that was going to be an issue, that they knew suburban women in particular were really turned off by the Trump administration, and they knew that being crushed by the gender gap would hurt his reelection chances. So he spent time with a group of there was 100 women in this focus group that they constantly sort of came back to and asked them questions to see where
the
they
pliability
were at. The pliability is, on,
sure.
on yeah. So every time that Trump did this, was it going to hurt the governor? And this is. Again, so politicians hate public pollsters sometimes. You always complain about it, but yet you're still using the same sort of social science methodology.
Well, it always comes back. third segment, let's really now get to it. You're a city resident.
Sure.
Nestor's a city resident. You care deeply about Baltimore City. That's why we're doing this. What does the next mayor, regardless of who he or she is, what do they have to do to hit the ground running, get this thing turned around? Dutch had some ideas. Curious,
sure.
And it seems there's some consensus. But what do you think the next mayor has to do?
Sure. And I go back to my idea that I think that they need to find ways to effectively figure out what citizens want, and not just what activist community wants, or not just what neighborhood association presidents want and those groups, to really try to figure out, you know, what Baltimoreans identify as the sort of the major problems facing the city, and some solutions perhaps they would like to see, or initiatives that they would like to see the city take care of. So what does the average citizen identify as a sort of a core problem? And I think it's actually problematic. So I'm a white person from Federal Hill. I've lived here for 6 years. I am not a long-term city resident in an African-American, a majority African-American city. It's those individuals, I think, that we need to make sure that their voices get heard. Because they make up the majority of the city, and maybe this is my kind of my pulsar perspective.
So this is your thought of renting the city versus owning the city?
No, I mean, I wouldn't put it like that. I don't want to put it in words.
But I think if you, I see that. I live in Federal
sure.
Hill, right?
Yeah, that's what do I.
I walk through Federal Hill, and I live at the harbor, and I think I have always felt like I'm a guy that this is where I live, and I don't feel like I want to leave anytime soon, hence doing this,
sure.
right, and being invested. But I definitely see people that they're only there until they're ready to meet their spouse, make a baby, move out, or they're 1 foot into, well, I'm renting, and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I would live somewhere else, as opposed to, hey man, I plopped down $295,000 on my place in Canton with my roof, and somebody got robbed down here and somebody got robbed there, and I can't go out, and I'm not leaving.
Sure.
I'm entrenched. That vote gets the same as a non-vote 2 doors down that somebody's renting, right?
And it's not that I think every vote should count equally. My argument is that we should, the next mayor, I think, should really, there always should be a focus, not just on those harbor-hugging districts and the harbor-hugging
right.
areas, that there a renewed focus. And I'm not to say that Mayor Catherine Pugh didn't try, or certainly, or Mayor Dixon or Mayor Stephanie Rollins-Blake, you know, certainly didn't do these things. But I think a continued or maybe perhaps renewed focus on those, on the communities that have been disproportionately affected by crime. So for every robbery that happens in Federal Hill, there's a murder that's happening.
Right.
And so what's happening in our city right now is an American tragedy. That much of a murder rate happening. I mean, you see, it makes national news if individuals are killed in other cities, but this type of death happens every single day.
So I
would like to see, that's my biggest thing. It's like, let's figure out, let's talk to the members in those communities. Let's effectively gauge the attitudes of individuals who live in those communities, and let's figure out what they see. Give them agency, and figure out what is not just what the activists think, but what the people think.
I think that is really on target. It's so consistent, Nestor. Dutch talked about public safety. We talk about Dan Roderick's been writing about it, Michael Olesker. And I think what people understand is it's not just one strategy. When you talk about mm-hmm. those neighborhoods, what I hear from you coming out is this passion about those neighborhoods that have such a rich history in Baltimore City. I kidded Dutch. I mean, as a little kid, I spent a lot of time at 612 Allendale Street in Edmondson Village. I mean, real strong neighborhoods throughout this city. And the thing that gets me going is I look around and I see, you know, if my grandchildren say, hey, let's walk up and get a snowball.
Mm-hmm.
We can walk up and get a snowball and sit out and enjoy the snowball and walk home. And it's a wonderful family experience. I believe that that's what every family in Baltimore City
sure.
wants for their children. They want their mom and dad or their grandfather and grandmother to be able to walk to the corner and get a snowball
mm-hmm.
and not be worried about getting hit with a random bullet. And it seems like a complex, comprehensive issue. It's jobs. It's public safety. As Dutch said, it's even infrastructure.
Well,
the city can't be falling apart.
Let me make
one more point. And I think it has to be, when we talk, and we talk about whoever the next mayor mm-hmm. is, in addition to all those things, where the rubber meets the road things, it has to be someone who makes us believe again that this city can be great again. I always come back to the bully pulpit because I believe it matters. And Nestor, I cut you off.
Well, this is where the pollsters come in, where the perception and the reality, right? Asking people questions about what they think about it, that's what they think. That's perception. And then the reality is, here are the dead bodies. Here are the statistics, and here are the numbers. So give me an example of a place or a study or a thing where my study is this. I get off planes and I fly all over the country. I fly all over the world and I'm 50. So I've been flying for 35 years to places, and a lot of places I'm a repeat visitor. And I go back to the same place, space, restaurant, area, region, 5 years later, 10 years later. And my wife and I always argue this male-female point-counterpoint where, you know, I look and say, well, this coffee's a 9 or that thing's a 7. And you rank and rate. You say, is this place getting better or is it getting worse? And recently, I've gotten off planes in Cleveland where it's getting better. You feel it. You see it. You get off a plane in Nashville. You see the growth. You feel it. You get off a plane in Charlotte where I've been going for 30 years, every 5, 7, 8 years. And I'm like, wow, this place has grown up. I look at this new thing down here, and this place looks vibrant. And it looks safe. And then I live in Baltimore, and the perception of it and the reality of it, and then where that bottom is and how it turns around starts with perception and then fixing it up. And I guess in our city, it's going to be law and order and the perception of all of that. So where do the polls come into all of that to be asked to gauge something that's going to be a part? The new mayor is going to come in and find someone like you and say, help me get data, help me get information to turn this tide.
So, I mean, listen, my suggestion always is that people should care a lot less what somebody like me thinks sitting from Federal Hill and a lot more what people think who live in areas that have been disproportionately affected by crime and poverty. And so the first thing that I would suggest anybody do is they would start to build out a way to effectively and consistently start asking the citizens and residents who live in those areas an effective way for them to give feedback to the government on things that are actually happening in their city. So I think there's a tremendous amount of things that are happening in those neighborhoods that we're missing. And I'm not sure what those things are, but I'm sure that we're missing something. And I think there's solutions, and I think there's intelligent people, and I believe very, very strongly in the collective wisdom of the masses, that together that there are solutions that the city has not thought about yet that they could certainly help to get there if they started to talk to these individuals more systematically in those neighborhoods. And that would mean going around and trying to find ways to build a sophisticated sort of sample of these residents who can give feedback through mechanisms that aren't just community associations. Nothing against community associations. I think that they're really great for a lot of different things. I don't think they're fully representative of the neighborhoods in which they represent.
Well, people looking to government also are looking for competency, right?
Well,
so one of the things that I know you
quick,
with,
I know
with the county executive side, that when you call to pull a permit, when you call a police officer, when you call for public service, when you show up because you need something, whatever that need would be, that can you get that done in the city?
And well, let me pick up on that, and I think you both will relate to this. This morning, I looked at Senator Bill Ferguson had a Facebook post, and I'm reading it, and my wife hears me go, "Yes," and she goes, "Yes, what?" And I said, Bill Ferguson just captured what I believe is the essence, not only of Baltimore Positive, but what local government should be. And Bill Ferguson had a story, I don't know if you saw it, where he reported on, he had gone to the new mayor, he had gone to Jack Young, and Jack Young had come to Annapolis, said, anything I can do for you, let's see what we can do, let's work together. Bill said, well, I tell you what I think is really important, Mayor. He said, every year we seem late opening the city pools. For whatever reason, all these thousands of city youngsters, when school lets out, are ready to go to the
Didn't
pool.
Didn't Angelos make a donation a couple years ago to open some pools?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I do.
So
the mayor,
here's the important point that I think. We talk about Baltimore Positive, and again, we're not looking at any individual. We're looking at big picture, and I think there's a big picture thing here, and that is the mayor says, let me look into that, Bill. I'll get back to you. He then goes back, and lo and behold, the mayor followed up. This is the William Donald Schaefer stuff. Went back,
found out, making a list.
He went back, and he said, we've got some of these issues. Senator Ferguson, I want you to speak directly to our folks in public works. Let's make sure these pools open on time. And that goes to what Malia said.
It's government
in these neighborhoods,
right?
That makes the city work. The city is a better place if those pools should be open on time, and by golly, those pools should be open on time. Because I got news for you. Come Memorial Day, The pools in Catonsville,
you know what's crazy?
And the pools in Towson will be open on time.
That's in my neighborhood too. And so Bill's my representative, or my senator, and that pool is probably maybe like 4 or 5 blocks from my house. And it was really sad last summer to walk by and see it's not filled up, it's not filled up, it's not filled up, and finally
there you go.
And it's full right now. I posted on that same post and I was like, Bill, so, the pool is full. I mean, you don't want to get in it right now, but it's full.
This is what we're going to do. I know we're running out of time. Malia, we don't let any of our guests come in without throwing them in the deep end and saying, let's let folks know a little bit more about you.
Gosh.
So when you're not polling, when you're not out there at the Sarah T. Hughes Center, when you have any, what does Malia Cromer do to relax?
I know. And this is like, because I'm really not that interesting of a person. And I have a small dog that I spend a lot of time with. I'm married. His name is Mike. My husband's name is Mike. My small dog.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike. My small dog's name is Porter. She's like a Yorkie mix of some sort.
Are you a movie person?
I'm an avid TV watcher.
What do you like? What do you watch?
Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones.
We have nerds.
Nestor and I think I think you and I are the only two people who have never seen Game of Thrones. My wife is addicted.
I love it. No, I think I love Sear. I think that we're still in the golden age of television.
Was that coffee or tea on the table in the Game of Thrones last week?
I have no idea. It doesn't matter to me.
Is it true? I heard the episode was dark it was actually hard to watch. It was really dark.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't matter.
It's a story.
I want to hear none of your criticism about it.
I don't have any criticism.
What do you punch in the car when you're listening to music? When you're stuck in the traffic coming over here?
I'm podcast more than music.
Okay.
But if you do music, what do you do? What's the last concert you saw?
Oh gosh. No,
come on, it's okay.
No, I want to express a really probably unpopular opinion. I feel like you're going to get really upset with me.
As you sit under Prince and Frank's apple.
Yeah, I actually don't care.
There you go.
Like
you're not a music person.
I'm not a music person. Matter of fact, and I will tell you this is the God's honest truth, that if I would go to a bar, which I really don't anymore, my homebody, but and if I would see live music being played, I'd make my husband leave. I don't want to hear anybody's live music.
I'm going to say the same thing to you that I would say to Peter DeLuz when we go to great places like State Fair, and he's like, I'll have the hamburger, the hot dog, or the french fries, and I'd be like, dude, you got to enjoy
it. They have some other things.
You know what I mean?
There's some Brussels sprouts here.
That you're missing out on the good stuff.
No, I'm not. I'm cool. I'm absolutely fine.
This is what I want in my pulse. I want focus
in my pulse.
Real quick, podcast. What podcast are you listening to now?
My favorite podcast is called The Bulwark. It is by Charlie Sykes.
Nestor takes notes. He likes all this.
Yeah, so he's a part of the sort of like the Never Trump Republicans. He's a former, I think he was with the Weekly Standard before it kind of went under. So The Bulwark, I think, is a collection of really smart sort of center-right commentary. And I think it gives a really clear view. I think it gives a really kind of interesting and clear view of the political landscape. They're not really beholden to Democratic interests, so they're not like full resist, but they're not sort of Trumpian either. And so I think that space, the occupied space of
the
center right,
the bulwark.
The occupied space of the center right, right now is an interesting perspective in American politics. So I listen to that a lot.
We may have to have you back to talk about that. Talk about your own podcast. It was roughly speaking,
Government Edition. So Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun and I, Wednesday we talked, we said, you know, we should do a limited series podcast during legislative session. We'll interview delegates, interview senators, and just get like the whole sort of Stephen Colbert, like the better know a district thing.
Right.
And so I was like, we should better know a state legislator. This would be really fun. And so Luke and I did 13 episodes during legislative session. Now, that's the Baltimore Sun's.
How long are your pods?
Oh, gosh, not this long. I'm being serious.
No, same. You do about 20 or 30 minutes. So that's what this will be.
I know. I'm saying they're like 20 or 30 minutes.
Right. That's what we're trying to do here.
you'll get there.
We should mention to people that Luke is the one that broke Healthy Holly. Did he break that while you were working on the podcast, Healthy Holly?
Luke is like a machine. I don't understand like how he functions. Like
I worked at the Baltimore Sun in the late 80s, late at night, when David Simon was coming in off the streets.
Yeah.
So I knew him as a kid. And in the modern era, what you need to do to break a story that doesn't want to be broken, whether it's Mueller down to whatever corruption. And this isn't the only, by the time this airs, there'll be another corrupt something, but journalism's how all this happens.
So he was doing that. He was doing that like in the midst of writing the daily, like what's going on in the Maryland General Assembly. Right. Like, he was still doing that beat reporting every single day. He was doing the podcast with me once a week, and then he ended up breaking this really huge story. It's amazing.
What did you learn about podcasting by doing
that? It's hard. God, that your jobs are a lot harder than mine. That it's a lot harder to ask the questions than to answer them. It was really difficult. Like, so I had never been. I had always. Since I came to Baltimore, people have always been asking me questions about, like, the poll, and I can easily answer questions about approval and disapproval and all that stuff in between. But I'd never had to ask people questions before, and it's super hard.
What did you learn about the legislature? General Assembly? What's your takeaway after doing this for one session?
The people were quite lovely, and I mean, this is like a rosy view of the world, but that I got to talk to a lot of really interesting people, and I found something that I liked individually about every single person I talked to. I walked away with a new appreciation for the work they did and more new appreciation for them as individuals. And I think that we have a tendency to sort of like paint people Democrat or Republican on the good team or the bad team or vice versa or whatever you think. But once you meet the individuals, you realize that most of them get in the business of being a part-time state legislator to do good for their constituents. And most of them have that focus. And it was really nice to hear.
Well, you know, it's a perfect place to stop because it's so positive. And I went to your webpage.
Okay.
And I was struck by the poll quote where you said, "I believe in the collective wisdom of the American people and the power of state and local government."
I do.
And it sounds like that came through. You're an optimist.
See, I thought that until this guy got elected. I was going to cut you off. You said that quote. Like, that's one of your
I believe in the collective wisdom.
Obviously, it's a core belief. You've said it. Yeah. And I was going to stop you at that point and say, I always did, too. You know, I thought there was a reason George Wallace didn't show up in the White House.
Sure.
You know, that's the way I felt like the whole time this thing was going on 3 years ago, I thought, you know, I know we have some – yeah, I use some terminology
sure.
I can't use. So, you know, some a-holes in our society, but I didn't think that a grand majority could allow what we've seen happen. So I think that there is a little shake in this that certainly Don and I have felt, people of our ideology and sort of normalcy have felt to what is going on right now.
One person for me, even if that person's president of the United States, doesn't shake my faith in America and the underlying sort of values of the American democracy and the representative democracy. And so at the same time that I think I can understand why people look at the president and their sort of their trust in the collective wisdom is shaken. I look at the individuals that were elected in Maryland to serve, and I think that, I mean, I'm one of the people who probably, if asked, would say the state is going in the right direction, and I think that's because we've elected a group of individuals that seem to be have the best interests of Marylanders at heart.
And then I live in a city. And then the mayor, you know, what you just said, by far, and Don always argues, because I would sit on the radio 15 years ago and say, these politicians suck and these politicians are crooked. And Don would say, no.
Just not true.
It's like saying all these ball players are entitled and these are, that's not true either. Right?
Perfect place to stop. Optimistic Malaya Cromer. This is Baltimore Positive.
I like
Episode 2 has been terrific. Thank you. Sarah T. Hughes, Center for Politics.
Field Politics Center.
Field Politics Center.
It's a mouthful.
Thanks. Hope you'll come back.
Thanks, Don. Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'll go decaf the whole time next time.
Okay, great.
State Fair, Catonsville.
Baltimore Positive. We are WNST.net, AM 1570 and WNST Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore Sports.